introduce our first invited lecturer, Dr. Catherine Caesar. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time singing your praises, other than to say that she teaches the history of art and architecture course, but and therefore covers the entire range of the history of art. But her principal interest is in modern art, which is it's kind of funny. My two interests in the world of art are Renaissance and modern, and I give a passing grade to the other periods in between before, but
me too. Yeah.
But my collection of art books is predominantly modern and Renaissance. So fortunately for us, she's going to talk about, she's going to focus on two figures who slot very, very well into our theme this semester. You couldn't have known that really in advance because we didn't get a chance to discuss it, but it's going to work out perfectly. So I'm going to turn the floor and the entire evening over to her. But before we do that, are there any questions? I did open up a discussion group. I hope you found it. I hope you can figure out how to use it if you want to. I did these about 12 years ago and it was very successful. But that was because I required everybody to contribute, and I'm not going to do that to you. But if you would like to post questions, I will look at it as I have time. You go to discussion board in Blackboard, and you can submit a topic, ask a question, pose a problem, something of the sort, and the rest of us, you and I, can come in and make comments or try to answer or try to disagree or try to agree, whatever we'd like to do. So if you want to participate in an ongoing dialogue, you can do that now on Blackboard. Yes?
I was just wondering about
people
here.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be like following along?
You know, that's an excellent idea. What I'm glad you mentioned that. I think what you want to do is use an hour as a good way of filling in some background that you really need to make sense of these individual figures that we're focusing on. I will put some subsequent, let's say, not exactly assignments, but suggestions for subsequent chapters that fit into the subsequent stream of lectures in the course. Okay? So I'll be doing that starting next week, and also starting next week, I hope I will get our hosting service up, and I'll be able to put all the videos on that, so if you're longing to see images as well as hear voices from the lectures, then you'll be able to do that. At least I hope you will, if I don't run into a snag, and you never know with this world of electronic equipment. Anything else that I can solve in about 30 seconds? In the way of a problem or question? On to Botticelli and Alberti, yes! I like Alberti.
Good evening, everybody. I've assigned two texts for tonight. And I brought in this comparison to lead us into a discussion of these texts, because we art historians bring in compare contrast. That's what we call these when we put up two images and we try to evoke a discussion of art style, the era, history through the comparison and contrast between these two images. I brought in a painting on the left, or an image of a painting on the left by a Renaissance artist named Masaccio. About 1426, his Madonna and Child. And I'm contrasting it with the Primavera, which you read about for tonight, by Botticelli, 1482. They're a nice contrast because they represent kind of two ends of the Quattrocento, the 400s, the 1400s, right? The Masaccio is from the first quarter of the century, and the Botticelli is from the last couple decades of the century. So they serve as kind of parentheses of this era. I also bring them in because they are representing, as I say, the two readings. But it's not a perfect comparison, and I'll explain why. Well, you can help me perhaps explain why. Why would the Masaccio on the left come to represent the Alberti? I think it's clear why the Botticelli represents the Botticelli reading. But why would the painting on the left represent Alberti at all? And if you don't know, you can guess. Yeah?
Well, it shows linear perspective, which is what he talks about.
Okay, very good. So, she said it shows linear perspective, which is what Alberti talks about. And what does linear perspective mean?
the three-dimensional, like, kind of making it look like, you know, three-dimensional. And there's a horizon line, and there's a center dot, and you make these in proportions to the red horizon.
Okay. Yeah, it's the perpetual goal of painting, perhaps, to make a 2D medium somehow appear 3D. Now, there are plenty of artists, especially in the period I study, the modern era, that reject the attempt to represent three-dimensionality in a 2D work, but they're still dealing with it, even if they're rejecting it. So, Alberti is talking about how to represent a figure within space. A figure that recedes into depth and mimics our natural sight. And we're going to be talking about that a lot because Alberti talks about that. Any other reason why I brought in the Masaccio? Yeah. Sure, very good. That's a key point in the Alberti.
That's what I was
going to
say.
Okay, good. Yeah. Yes. Okay, that's a good compare-contrast point. Very good. Also, Alberti discusses Masaccio in the preface to his text. And it is one of his sources for this work. It is one of his inspirations. He enters Florence, and we'll talk about that, the first part of the Quattrocento, and he sees Masaccio's works, and he is blown away by his work and by his linear perspective and by the monumentality and profundity of the work. So I'm showing you the Masaccio as a representation of what Alberti believes to be perfect work, the finest of art. As I said, of course, I bring in the Primavera because this text, The Portrayal of Love, discusses the Primavera and what its sources are, what it means, and the chapter we read is about reading the poem, reading the painting, right? So as I said, this is our nice, neat comparison here, but it's not very neat for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm using two paintings to represent very different works. You read a primary source, right? This is Alberti's On Painting, published in 1436. Okay, this is a text written contemporary to the period that helps us understand the period and its goals and its priorities. The other reading is not a primary source, it's a secondary source, talking about Botticelli. Okay, so in a sense, we have two different types of texts for tonight. It's also not the best comparison for one reason, because I brought in the Masaccio to represent Alberti, But Masaccio was already dead by the time Alberti wrote this text. He had died just a few years before Alberti published on painting. Also, and I wonder if we'll have time to get into it. If not, you can remind me to bring it up. There are some things about the Masaccio work that Alberti wouldn't have liked. And indeed would have preferred elements of Botticelli's Primavera. Totally outside of the text that we read for tonight, this is a nice, neat art historical comparison that could be used for any study of the Quattrocento, because the styles indeed are quite distinct. We already mentioned that the subjects are distinct and that we have a Christian subject in contrast to a mythological subject. Of course, there are Christian elements to this. And indeed, there are mythological elements to this, too. But the subject is distinct. How might you describe the stylistic difference in this work, the way the artist chose to represent these scenes? What stands out to you?
One, there's a lot of movement going on, and another
one is
still.
Okay. So Botticelli's work seems to symbolize movement. All the gestures are kind of uniting the whole work, and the scene seems more static to you. Okay, good. What else?
Yeah. The portions of the characters on the left are slightly different from the one on the right.
How so?
You're looking up at an angle left. Madonna, they're much bigger than the foreground. The point where she's being seen is about bigger than the foreground, whereas everybody else in the slide show it all pretty much.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but Madonna looks like she'd be 20 feet tall.
Yeah, she'd be really tall. You're right, exactly. And what does that mean about Masaccio's figuration?
Not very good.
Well,
it doesn't meet the requirements in the on
the
painting at all.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like,
well, and yeah, interestingly, the figures are massive.
Yeah.
You know, both in terms of the proportion of the work, and they give us the sense of absolutely monumental forms. Which is in direct contrast not only to the proportion of the forms in the Botticelli work, but also the entire way that he paints them. We have these massive sculptural forms as objects in this work. And look at the Botticelli. Everybody is lightness and air and linearity. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess I had a couple of thoughts. One was that the Madonna is huge. For the reason that you stated, it makes me think of El Greco's work, which some of his figures were so elongated and seemed so huge. I don't know if the period is even near the same. And when I look at the Madonna and Child, I see such a nice triangle. Everything seems so very right there, and there are architectural elements in that piece, whereas in the Botticelli, you feel, and I would never have thought about the triangles until I read the primary work.
Right.
But you see the use of triangles in the Botticelli work, but in a much more fluid fashion or something. And she's off-center. The Venus, is that right? The mm-hmm. central figure is off-center, which I think goes back to something that someone behind me was saying. So the whole composition and the fact that you're looking up at her and she's off-center seems new as compared to Alberti's work, which is so rigid.
Right. Good.
And would Botticelli have been influenced by Alberti's piece in the writing on painting? Would that... Do you see what I'm asking?
Certainly. And Botticelli
Whereas
was praised for his...
Whereas Masaccio wouldn't have because he was dead, right?
He was dead, yes.
Okay.
But yeah, Botticelli was praised for his use of one-point perspective. And indeed, Alberti loved Botticelli's work. And so I'm starting off with this compare-contrast between the monumentality and massiveness of the Masaccio, leading us towards the end of the century with the Botticelli. But indeed, there are aspects of both of these works that Alberti absolutely celebrated.
Well, wouldn't Alberti not like the fact that everything is so statuesque in the Saccio?
He did not like the proportions of the figures, right?
Yeah, like but also like how they're just so statue, because he always, you know, he talks so much about, you know, there should be movement and the proportion should be, you know, in, you know, if the knee is bended, it should look like a bended knee, or, you know, when they're saying not so statue, it should look like more movement.
Exactly. I mean, you have to realize that Alberti entered Florence in the first quarter of the 15th century, sees Masaccio, and Masaccio represented an absolute revolution in painting. Nothing had ever been seen like this before. And so even though there's aspects of Masaccio's work that he wouldn't ultimately celebrate, it inspired him to write this treatise on the new Renaissance painting, which is ultimately what it is. Okay, well let's start out by looking at the preface of On Painting, prologue. Which is on page 39 and 40. And that'll lead us into who is Alberti, what are his priorities, and we'll get into a discussion of that, which will lead us to the Botticelli towards the end of class, okay? From looking at the prologue, what is important to Alberti? Nature. Where does he say that?
Bottom half of the first paragraph. This, I believe, as many said, that nature, the mysteries of things, have grown old and tired, and all the produces, either geniuses or giants, which are more beautiful and more glorious day, as she has to make some marvelous new fun.
Okay. Thus, I believe, as many said, that nature, the mysteries of things, have grown old and tired. And what is he saying there?
Part of nature, we have to understand the portion of nature, the depth of nature, beyond the form. That's the best way we can study and learn how to.
Right. Nature is absolutely one of his inspirations. But what is he saying there about she no longer produced either geniuses or giants? What is he referring
to? He's saying that really amazingly gifted artists don't seem to be as predominant in their natural form. They don't just come about as they used to in the ancient times, he's saying, and that's just kind of phased out, or nature doesn't seem to be producing those.
Okay. So ultimately he was feeling that there was a time that there were no works of great genius. Nature had grown old and tired. She no longer produced geniuses or giants, perhaps, such as Masaccio and Botticelli. Botticelli hadn't really begun painting yet by that point, but you get the idea. So then what happened? Yeah.
He believes in the power of the individual to work and understand and study and make that relation of his studies to his art.
Absolutely. That's what he's talking about. Nature no longer produced geniuses or giants. He's absolutely celebrating the individuality of the artist, which is new, right? Prior to this era, the medieval era is characterized by the guild system, in which artists were craftsmen. There were not elevated artists. There was no high art. They produced objects.
But doesn't he say in here that that wasn't true of painting, that a painter was never considered a craftsman? He was always an artist. Didn't he say that someplace in here?
Well, he said in the ancient world, the even painters were revered above the rest.
Above
the
all other
world,
artists,
perhaps in the ancient world, right? And that's what he's ultimately reviving here, right?
And what he says, by our diligence and industry, we can kind of learn things, even if it's not a gift of nature. Like, he's going to break it down how you can learn to be a great artist, even.
And that's what he does.
Above,
right?
And beyond the gift of nature.
Exactly. Good. Okay, so, but he thinks that there's no geniuses anymore, and then what happens? What is the epiphany he has?
Well, he returns to Florence.
Yes.
And when he returns to Florence, he realizes that after his long exile, that there are these geniuses that he's longing to have seen again.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. That's what he says. Since then, I have been brought back here to Florence from the long exile in which we Alberti have grown old, into this our city adorned above all others. And indeed, his family was exiled from Florence. It wasn't until 1402, I believe, that the Albertis were allowed to return to Florence. So Alberti was trained in Bologna, and so he does literally re-enter the city of Florence as the sort of emissary of his family, and he sees the amazing things that are happening there. Who are making these fabulous objects? Who does he praise? Yes, who? Does he say?
Mincio, Luca, and Masaccio.
Yeah. Masaccio being one. He says, I have come to understand that many men, but especially in you, Filippo. Well, who's Filippo? We'll talk about that. And then our close friend, Donato the sculptor, and in others like Nencio, Luca, and Masaccio, there is genius for every praiseworthy thing. So what he's doing is celebrating his contemporaries, and we're going to talk for a minute about who he's celebrating there, Masaccio being one of them. Okay, so arts, nature had been relatively dead, and he realizes that they have been revived once he comes back into Florence. He is celebrating the role of the painter as the highest art, the highest creator, not craftsman anymore, but creator. What are his other goals, as indicated in this prologue? Yeah.
One of them seems to be like, he wants to acquire wide fame. I mean, that's something he repeats all the time.
Okay.
Acquiring his wide fame that is deserving of it.
And what does he mean by fame? Not riches.
That an artist is not just like a manual craftsman, like a shoemaker. No,
right.
Because he's like creating something new, something so beautiful. And it takes a lot of intellectual effort. You have to know the amateur and all that stuff. So.
It's absolutely an intellectual enterprise, right? Absolutely. It is not only a question of manual skill, it's a question of cerebral skill, right? Mm-hmm. Good. And you hopefully will make a name for yourself, acquire great fame, not necessarily riches. That's not his priority, but rather be respected by your peers.
And along with that, it seems that he thinks he's the one to set down the method for doing so. It's your perspective, the ancients who had models and people who to emulate, and now that doesn't exist, so it's going to lay it out.
Very good. Very good. And first of all, you said the ancients, right? And that's one of the biggies here, right? That he is reviving the work of the ancients. And primarily ancient painters. Okay, so ancient Greek and Roman classical painters he's talking about. This is the example that they all have. But, as you say, they don't even have these examples. We don't have rich examples of ancient painting, because painting is not a hardy art form for the most part. And so he's saying what geniuses these men of the Renaissance era will be, because they don't even have models with which to work.
They're rediscovering models.
Right, exactly. And so how does one paint in the style of an ancient Greek or Roman painter? Well, let me tell you. But it's not simply a rehearsing of classical principles, certainly. It's imbued with contemporary mathematics, geometry, skill, knowledge, history. But it's absolutely indebted to the ancients.
Well, he even says at one point, to touch on the whole, he is not after money. He says that painters who only seek wealth, or like lot of money from their works, like, end up dying off and they kind of fall to the wayside. But painters who really, they don't live on past their years or whatever, but painters who love painting gain their fame and renown, and then the riches come and their works live forever. Like,
you become immortal, right? Yeah. And perhaps even divine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Our fame ought to be much greater than if we discover unheard of and never forcing hearts and minds without teachers or without the model.
On page 40 at the top.
There seems to be so much a discussion of conceptual art.
Let me look at that. Our fame ought to be much greater than we discover unheard of and never before seen arts and sciences without teachers or any model whatsoever. Yeah, that's what you were saying, sort of saying there, right?
Yeah.
So what do you mean, conceptual art?
Well, he says they're creating art without the background that things are being created without precedent. Which is very much what modern art is about now.
Rejecting all of the past?
I think stepping away from it and trying to create some intellectual people.
Okay.
And I guess I just puzzled. He said that, but then he spends the whole document defining the geometry. It starts out conceptual, appreciating the conceptual intellectual aspects, but then goes on to develop, trying to define it mathematically. I guess I was struggling with this.
Well,
isn't he also talking about architecture as well? About forms that come out of nowhere, like Franklin Lloyd Wright or Gaudi, stand the test of time, but it's not that there's anything. It's not manufactured. It's not trying to drive something. It's just there.
Well, first of all, he never rejects the old. Okay, he is celebrating himself and his peers for being able to rise to the level of the ancients without models around them on a daily basis. Okay, however, he absolutely says that one does not merely slavishly copy the past. Indeed, it is a rebirth, a renewal, and a novel study of the work of art. Innovation is essential here, although you are always beholden to the past to a certain extent. Does that help at all? I mean, it's a constant dialogue between the old and the new, perhaps, in Alberti. Who's going to... Yeah, go ahead.
It reminds me of when Aristotle's talking about modern arts, and that like, he's gone... He says there are people who can just do and it's just innate in them. And there are others who... following structure and form can do, so we need to take those who can do and from that extrapolate a method. And so he recognizes that the people who can do, it's innate, it's there, and for that they are prized because they've been able to accomplish without that method, without that form, without formal instruction.
But if you're not that, here's the manual, right?
Exactly. And you can aspire to this, and I don't know, he doesn't so much get into this, but you can infer even if you're talking
right. Good. Yeah.
But couldn't it be said that in this time, backing your thesis up mathematically would have been looked at like he would have been looked at as more credible since the humanists, this time period still, cherished so much mathematics and geometry
science,
and that he'd almost have more, validity or credit if he backed up his theories mathematically.
So you think that's why he employed geometry?
No, I think he's truly saying if you don't have natural talent, you need to understand the geometry behind it, but it also gives like some sort of fundamental basis to take for other people to look at painters and take them seriously.
With absolute credibility.
Perhaps,
yes. Right. And I believe that he thinks that anybody, well, I don't know about that, ones with superior intellect can learn to paint. It's not necessarily a question of innate talent, but that it can be learned. So let me see if there's anything else I wanted to discuss in the preface. He says at the beginning of that last paragraph on page 40, as you work from day to day, you persevere in discovering things through which your extraordinary genius acquires perpetual fame. If you find the leisure, it would please me if you should look again at this, my little work on painting, which I set into Tuscan for your renown. And then he says you will see three books. The first, All Mathematics. I'm skipping a little. The second book puts the art in the hand of the artist, distinguishing its parts and demonstrating all. The third introduces the artist to the means and the end, the ability and desire of acquiring perfect skill and knowledge in painting. So he's setting forth his little treatise here, okay? And I think we've done a good job of kind of going over some of the main things that he introduces. Let me show you some more images here. Can you see it okay? This is Filippo. He talks about Filippo, right? This is the architecture of Filippo Brunelleschi. And this is literally what Alberti saw when he entered Florence. This is the dome of the Florence Duomo. The Duomo is the cathedral of the city. And the dome was executed by Brunelleschi starting in the 1420s. 1436, this was published. And we'll talk a little bit more about the publication in a couple minutes. But I just want to talk to you a little, show you a little bit about what these inspirations were. We already talked about the Masaccio a little. Does anybody remember what he says about Filippo? He talks about him in a couple different places during the text. Does anybody remember what he says about the dome?
It's just almost like it's perspective, or it's, I mean, he had to have mathematical genius to do this, and it's like, this is the concrete way that you can see that mathematics is needed in art in order to create a form. It's
right.
Almost like, this is the concrete way, now let me tell you how you do it in painting.
Okay.
That's why I thought.
And Alberti, of course, is an architect, and he designed some buildings, which I'm going to show you briefly. Yeah. Very good. Yeah, very good. Well, first of all, have any of you been to Florence and you've seen the dome? I mean, you see it from everywhere, right? You can't miss it. So he's talking about the dominant monument in the city, and it's brand new, that Brunelleschi built it. And it was indeed quite a feat of engineering. And he talks about the fact that not a lot of wood was used to create the dome. He also said that there was no centering system that was used. Well, why is this significant? Well, it's sort of a complicated issue, but let me just say here that to build a dome of this scale, which had not been built since the Pantheon, was incredibly difficult. And one system would be, in order to build up the dome to reach the height of it, the workers would have to build a centering device made of timber, made of wood, on which could rest the exterior, and that would eventually be taken away. Okay, but if you were going to use a centering device, the story goes that it would take, I don't know, all of the trees in Florence or half of the trees in Florence or something like that. So that would be ridiculous, right? It would be this incredible waste of this natural material. Brunelleschi designed a scaffolding system and a hoisting system so that none of that had to be used. The scaffolding could be attached to the already built sections of the of the dome, and then this hoisting system could be used to bring the materials up to the dome. So not only is it this monumental dedication to the city of Florence and all that it represents in Italian Renaissance culture, but also it's this absolute innovation in architecture and in engineering. So, of course, he is respecting Filippo. Filippo Brunelleschi also had developed a system of perspective before Alberti did. It said that he went to Rome and developed a perspective system. So Alberti's system is, of course, in dedication to Brunelleschi's and building off of Brunelleschi's. He talks about Donato, who is the sculptor Donatello. We now refer to him as Donatello. And I'm showing you things that Alberti would have seen in Florence. I'll just show you quickly two sculptures from the facade, niches in the facade of the Orsa Michele structure in Florence. This is his depiction of St. Mark. It dates from 1411 to 1416. And Donatello is considered to be an innovator in 15th century sculpture. He returned to the lessons of the ancients. And indeed, there were a lot more examples of ancient sculpture than there were ancient paintings. So in a sense, it was a lot easier for the sculptors. The massiveness, the monumentality of the face of the figure, the drama of the figure's face, the voluminous folds of the drapery, the way he geared the proportions so that it could be best seen from the ground below, was absolutely inspirational to Alberti. A few years later, Donatello completed a sculpture of St. George toward the same site, the Orsa Michele in Florence. It was about 1415 to 19. These are marble sculptures. Here we have a more youthful man who is poised at this quiet moment in the drama. And there's an intensity to his face, but it comes out of this very pregnant moment without any actual mobility. This is one of actually the most amazing parts of the sculpture. This is the relief that appears below the sculpture, also by Donatello, in which we see St. George fighting with the dragon. Nobody had ever seen relief sculpture like this before. What's so great about it? Movement, and how is the movement portrayed?
Almost like a picture that's taken, like a live action shot, just very, I don't know, you just almost see everyone like moving. Like,
I mean, does it look like marble?
No.
I know it's probably difficult for some of you to see, but he has this incredible delicacy of detail in which the figures seem to sort of be subtly emerging from the background behind them. The background is treated as this negative space, and these forms come out in sometimes almost three-dimensionality, sometimes in just this very subtle relief. But he's absolutely reworking the marble in this new pictorial style that really no one had seen before.
So the figure on the right is, I think I'll have to refer to her, but
female.
You know, is she like then less forward on purpose then? And she's less defined?
Absolutely. I mean, some of it has been decayed over time too, but he is absolutely playing with these different levels of depth to express the drama of the piece. There's Masaccio, but let's get back to that. So let's just discuss who Alberti is for a second. He designed the facade of Santa Maria Novella here in Florence. So we know that he was an architect. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Alberti wrote three books. This is his first on painting. He also wrote a series of books on architecture. And he wrote another book on sculpture. This is, again, is his first. He published two versions of On Painting. The first, De Pictura, was published in 1435 in Latin. What we read is a translation of the Tuscan version, published the year later, called Della Pictura. So he translated his own Latin into Tuscan. What does that tell you about some of Alberti's goals?
Well, he obviously wanted not just the educated elite to understand painting. If he translated it into Tuscan, he wanted the basic people, the everyday people, to understand it as well.
Right, absolutely. So painting might be one of the loftiest enterprises that one can achieve, but he's not trying to limit his study, his knowledge, to those that can read Latin, right? He's translating it into the vernacular so that it can be read widely. Does anybody happen to know what Alberti knew about painting? Have I shown you an Alberti painting yet?
No.
I looked everywhere to try and find one. And could, you did. I came across this criticism from one of his contemporaries that said he knew more about instruction than he did the actual.
You didn't paint?
Ability.
He wasn't a big painter. Right. He wasn't a big sculptor either, and he wrote a treatise on sculpture. And of course, there were those that criticized him for being a dilettante, right? For not knowing enough about the subject to publish on it. And indeed, he didn't just publish on it, he wrote the sole Renaissance text on painting. Now, interestingly, 35 years prior to the publication of On Painting, there was another text by a man named Cennino Cennini. He wrote a text called Libro dell'Arte, the Book on Art. But that is widely considered not to be a Renaissance text, but actually to describe the techniques of the medieval era. You know, so he's writing as kind of the one who summarizes everything that had come before in the medieval era. It's Alberti who is representing the new seen through the ancient or the past, but the new just the same, right? He is the humanist scholar, and thus it's exceedingly different from Cennini's book.
Well, it almost seems in the prologue as though Alberti dismisses everything that happened in the medieval age as there was nothing there, nature wasn't producing artists, so it's like, almost like it didn't exist.
Exactly. It was a really long blip, right? Okay. Alberti designed the facade for Santa Maria Novella. It was a Gothic structure that already existed, and indeed elements of the facade had already existed, facade being the front of a building. And he redesigned it, putting this sort of Roman temple, second level, very ancient, right? Classical. Of course, we know where that's coming from. And he designed these volutes on either side of that Roman temple element. And volutes were actually used copiously after Alberti produced them. This is one of the first times that they were ever produced. And it, what it did was unite the upper and lower story and also hid the aisles that were on the exterior, that you can see from the exterior here on either side of the facade. So actually a very innovative architectural element. Just show you one other monument by him. This is called the Malatesta Temple. And it's in Rimini, Italy. And it's unfinished. It is unfinished. You see the whole second level hasn't really been completed yet. It's a fascinating building. We don't really have time to go into it, but if you're ever interested to work on something like this, the patron, Malatesta, was a fascinating evil man, and this is his sort of monument to himself and his mistress. And he hired Alberti to complete it, or not to complete it, as the case may be. But anyway,
why it wasn't completed?
No. But it wasn't uncommon for things not to be completed. I don't know if the patron died or ran out of money. I don't know. You can tell me if you read on this. anyway, I'm showing you these works, and there are others to show you that Alberti was indeed a well-known architect, not necessarily by the time this was written, but during the Quattrocento. Okay. Let's go back to that. That's book one, right? Did you love reading about linear perspective? It's the longest chapter of the book. Let's talk about this image for a second and what it means. And I'm not a painter, but we can talk a little bit about what a system is. But ultimately, what I really want to talk about is what is implied by his system. What does it show about his view of the world and art? Linear perspective, and Alberti is using a one-point perspective system. When I say one-point perspective, that means that it's coming from a single eye. And I don't even know what all these... I don't know what Z means. But it assumes a static viewer or artist, right? Either one establishes one-point perspective. And it is all based on the height of the artist, right, of the person producing the work. From my eye, I look forward towards the artwork, towards the object that I'm creating, and if I were up here, then my eye would hit right here at the V, the vanishing point. So this is the base. Down here is the base, okay, so the base of the field. Up here is the vanishing point where my eye meets, and then I draw a system of diagonal lines uniting the vanishing point and the baseline. What this is effectively giving me is a field of space, a field of vision, so that I can figure out how each object can fit into the system and will be properly proportioned and properly sized so that they seem to recede into space and that the depth is believable. And, of course, this employs mathematics and geometry, as he discusses. And not necessarily Alberti's, but linear perspective systems are taught in every single basic drawing one class in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Presumably. So it is absolutely still employed as a means to properly proportion your figures and then artwork into construct a believable space. What are some of the premises of this type of system? What type of work does this create? What does it suggest about the artist and his perception and his view of the world and the way that he paints? Because this is an arbitrary system. It's one based on mathematics, but it's arbitrary. Yeah.
Yeah, it suggests that the artist's viewpoint is the viewpoint of the audience as well.
Say that again?
The viewpoint of the artist is the viewpoint of the audience as well.
Okay. Okay. So it perhaps emphasizes that individuality that we've talked about in terms of the artist. Yeah.
Also, the fact that there is a system, art can be a free-for-all. There has to be, you know, there has to be some sort of order, some sort of form to make something beautiful, or for someone to actually be able to see something or portray something well.
Okay. Okay. So there is a mode that everyone needs to fit into. It's not a free-for-all, as you say. Good.
And also implies an immense amount of patience on the part of the artist to study before starting to do his work. I mean, just in terms of trying to figure out what the different perspectives are, because doesn't he talk about once you've got one perspective, then you try to get the other perspectives and you figure out how one particular, like your height, and then how something else is in relationship to your height, so you draw another pyramid, and then how all your pyramids intersect, and you have little pyramids inside bigger pyramids inside bigger pyramids.
Right. Yeah, good.
So there's a lot of study involved in it.
Indeed. Is there a hand back there?
Yeah, that he
values
nature.
How does this show that he values nature?
Well, I mean, the desire to capture reality is time to
actually
perceive.
Okay, so...
that you can capture reality.
So it assumes that one can...
like, depict authentically what is real.
Absolutely, which is an interesting assumption, right? but yes, nature is the inspiration, absolutely. Was there another hand? Yeah.
Step by step.
Right. That can be learned and taught. Right.
Something that also basically implies that the assumption of art is that it doesn't need to reflect something in perspective and maybe see that as opposed to maybe something else in free fall. It's an implication here to be a great artist.
Yeah, I mean, it's no small assumption, and I mean, especially considering the era I study in which Renaissance optics and perception is turned upside down, right? But it's an interesting assumption that, and he doesn't even really mention it that much, that the absolute goal is to make things look as they do in reality. That art should be, that painting should sort of disguise itself as a window onto the world, that 2D should accurately represent 3D or disguise itself as 3D, which is an interesting assumption. What is the basis for the system? What is the... Yeah.
It seems to be this very strong conviction that what the artist is representing is in the first place orderly and has a certain exactitude to it. If I were to dedicate myself to a certain guise of art, it'd be very difficult to do so. I don't know, I just feel that there's a presupposition that everything's very orderly.
Okay, right. So where's the chaos in all of this? The important, that essential part of life, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, the chaos is a very kind of conspicuous absence. So.
Right. I agree. Yeah.
But wouldn't it also be like, because, you know, how he basically says the medieval period was void of all great artists, and if you look at medieval painting, it, to us it kind of looks like flat, like it tends to not have perspective. And so wouldn't this be, he would basically be rejecting that by saying, in order to be a true artist of any caliber, like, you know, to be an artist, or to be a true painter, you have to depict what is real in 3D. Nothing can look flat.
Right.
And that means you stink.
Exactly. So it rejects other motivations for creating work, like, say, to capture spirituality. Instead, it's about more mimicking the natural world. Yeah?
Yeah, philosophically, the assumption is that everyone sees the same perspective. That the perspective is all alike,
equal, and identical. Because we can all use the system?
Right. And not only can we use the system to create, we use the system to break it down into different parts.
Right.
Analyze and critique it. Because aren't we all seeing the same thing?
Well,
right. Good, that's interesting. Yeah, I want to bring that up. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know much about modern art, but isn't, like, modern art can be interpreted a lot of different ways, where he's saying this, I mean, there's only one way to interpret kind of a three-dimensional.
And not necessarily that there's only one way to interpret it, but that we all have similar goals in what we're trying to achieve, or at least these should be the goals.
Yeah.
These should be the goals. Yeah.
Well, I kind of got the impression that he was looking for beauty, because toward the end of his piece, he said, that you should eliminate those things that would be unattractive to make everything go together. So it's not necessarily a portrayal of reality.
It's an idealized one.
Yeah, idealized.
Okay, yeah, good.
Yeah.
Well, this is an idealized system, too, right?
Yeah.
But he says you have to start with reality, because he talks about how you have to start with the bone structure and then add muscle and then cover up what's ugly with flowing robes.
Yes, yeah, right. Very good, yeah.
Plato basically been rediscovered and revived. And in Plato's metaphysics, you have mathematical principles right below truest reality. Is that, can you look past that, or is that part of his interpretation? It's maybe not outright, but in his thinking, seeing his mathematical principles with these things up, as Plato would say, you know, metaphysically speaking in his own way, you're looking at the things and how they're connected to one another mathematically, and see those and get away from them. Physical, and Plato saying that's a higher reality. He's looking for beauty, capital B.
Right.
Out there he is. Not in a metaphysical way, but just in a way of, if I'm going to emulate this, I need to use mathematical.
Right, right. And he was absolutely trained in a Neoplatonist environment, so that absolutely could be related there. And Plato didn't have the highest view of art either, a much higher view of mathematics and science. So, Book one perhaps starts there. You know, I'm not saying that that's the cause, but that was absolutely in the air. Think too of what the basis of this system is. Yes, it's geometry and mathematics, but where does it all originate from? Proportion. Whose proportion?
The artist.
Right. The human, right? It's not based on the scale of things out there in nature, although, of course, we are part of that, but it's based on the scale of the human body. And it's geared towards different sizes of human bodies. He talks about how this should be divided into brachia, which is a third of the size of the human body, ultimately. He goes on to change that in later books. But it's based on me, my scale, my size. And so although I am employing a mathematical system, everything is based on my line of sight and my size. So what does that say about Alberti's system?
It's limiting.
It's what?
It's limiting.
Well, sure.
Subjective.
Subjective, yeah. It has subjective elements to it. Perhaps, but it's open to everybody. Everybody can be their own egoist, I guess. Just that art is centered around the individual, around man.
So he's not going to be very much into still lifes.
Well, I mean, the subject doesn't matter, although he prefers
portrait type
heroic subjects. People. But the issue is that he's, or one of the issues is that he is not, you know, he talks about dedicating his work to the gods and that sort of thing, but this is human-scaled art. It's not the scale of, say, a Gothic cathedral. Is a Gothic cathedral human-scale?
No.
Uh-uh. No. It towers above us. Alberti is advocating a work that celebrates the human. And indeed, what does he say? What happens with proportions here? What? Everything in a painting is scaled to what proportion?
To the man being drawn or the human being drawn.
Right. To me.
Right.
So the entire sort of microcosm of a painting is scaled towards the creator. This was new, this type of vision. It's also not an incredibly dynamic vision. One-point perspective is kind of static, in that it has one vanishing point, right? There are 2-point and 3-point perspectives also, but Alberti is limiting his to a 1-point perspective. So it's creating kind of, his works are excellent for documenting literature, scripture, mythology. It's not a dynamic system, one that celebrates motion, although he talks about motion, but that's primarily in the gesture of his figures. Ultimately, he's creating a graph of space that will control our perception of nature. And so again, that premise that nature can be controlled, observed, and understood by the human represents this new Renaissance vision.
What does he say? What does he like bringing his work?
Hmm?
What do you think bringing his work is good?
Bernini's?
It comes in. Yeah, I mean, I know he's Baroque, but he's later. But would he like his sculpture that is so
lifelike? I don't know. What do you think?
I think he would, because it's really lifelike.
Bernini doesn't always idealize, though.
That's true.
So he might not agree with Bernini's conception of beauty. Okay, so let's see. Why don't we go to book two? I think.
Thank you.
Well, wait, sorry. Before we do that, let's go to page 55. And I just as an example of what I was talking about in terms of everything being...
I don't think you gave us...
We don't have 55. We go from 53 to 56.
Yeah.
Oh, that's one fault.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Well, I'll read you out loud then. You can all sit back and listen to story time for a second. He's talking about his perspective system. He says, thus all things are known by comparison. Okay, because the proportional system is creating comparative items. For comparison contains within itself a power which immediately demonstrates in objects which is more, less, or equal. Yes, that's comparison. He says, since man is the thing best known to man, perhaps Protagoras, by saying that man is the mode and measure of all things, meant that all the accidents of things are known through comparison to the accidents of man. So he's talking about this perspective system. Everything is relational to one another, okay? It's not necessarily relational to anything outside of it besides the human. Okay, so we are the point to which all of art returns. Everything we know is through ourselves. Okay, now let's go to book two. Page 63. What does he talk about in this book? This is the second longest book.
Composition.
Composition. Color. Isn't this where he talks a lot about light and shadow and...
Yeah.
Don't use too much white.
He talks about three main things.
Circumscription, composition, and reception.
Okay, good. Circumscription, composition, and reception?
Reception of light.
Reception of light, right, exactly, light. Okay, so now, beyond perspective, he's going to talk about some of the other elements of this system. On page 63, how does he define the worth of painting?
He equates it to like a divine force. He said, you know, says it makes the dead almost seem alive.
Thus, the face of a man who is already dead certainly lives a long life through painting, so it immortalizes. Good.
It joins us to the gods.
Yes. Some think that painting shaped the gods who were adored by the nations. It certainly was their greatest gift to mortals, for painting is most useful to that piety which joins us to the gods and keeps our souls filled, full of religion. So again, the lofty values of painting. He says on the next page, similarly, sort of three quarters down the page, in italics, he says, moreover, painting was given the highest honor by our ancestors. For although almost all other artists were craftsmen, the painter alone was not considered in that category. Okay, so didn't you bring that up? So even in ancient times, we have the painter being raised above craftsmen. next page, let me point out something to you there, too, right in the middle, page 65. This is just in keeping with what we were talking about in terms of how Alberti views the role of the artist in the artwork. Trismegistus? Does anybody know how to pronounce that? Trismegistus. Thank you. An ancient writer judged that painting and sculpture were born at the same time as religion. For thus he answered Asclepius, mankind portrays the gods in his own image from his memory of nature and his own origins. Again, man is at the center of that universe. Okay, so let's just talk briefly, what is circumscription, composition, and reception of light? He starts talking about circumscription on 68.
Circumscription is your outline.
Yeah. Right. Why is outline important?
It helps you proportion. Helps you accomplish.
Yeah, it gives you your boundaries.
Your boundaries.
Okay. Good. It gives you your boundaries. Boundaries from what? Between what and what?
Between
your field of vision, I guess, almost, in terms of where you're going to fill in the details in the composition, where it's going to draw from, and where you're going to have your proportions in terms of depth. And
he also talks about the veil, like you basically make a grid, and so then
and you put on that veil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so you like, so you can get the accurate like cheek and everything to line up with, because you only paint one section of the. Of what you're thinking at a time, so you kind of line it all up.
Okay. In this chapter, Alberti talks about what a painter should paint. What is the realm of the painter? He talks about on this page, very top of the page. What does the painter paint?
Things we see.
Right. Painting strives to represent things seen. So that is the realm of the painter, to represent the visual world. So in accordance with that, why is an outline or a circumscription important? Yeah.
Place it in perspective.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Similarity of other objects, like background, foreground, surrounding.
Right.
To make it 3D.
If the painter represents things seen, the boundary of things that are seen is the outline. It separates us from other things. And it separates us from the atmosphere, the world around us. So circumscription, the boundaries of objects in the world, figures and other things, are essential to representing this realm of things seen that he's calling the subject matter of painting. Okay. Yeah, and honestly, I don't understand the veil. I need to talk to some of my colleagues and find out if anybody really still wears veils in order to paint.
Was the veil kind of like blinders to kind of...
No, it was a literal veil. It was a net,
uh-huh.
A rectilinear net that they hung up like this so that they had a grid that they could look through and place things on the grid.
Well, okay. In art class in high school, like they had us draw a light pencil, like a grid over it, and they would give us a picture, and then we would
grid the picture itself, and so then we got all the proportions right, because we knew in this grid we had to paint this much of the cheek and the light and the, this. I'm assuming it's the same thing, but maybe an actual veil, which I didn't realize.
Right. Okay. Okay, so that is circumscription. What is composition? The other, the second key element he addresses in this chapter.
Parts are fit together.
Mm-hmm. You go through what you said with the veil, and you start to put the parts together like a puzzle.
Exactly, exactly. It's how the pieces of your canvas fit together. The organization. Talks about this on page 70. Circumscription, just right in the middle of the page, which pertains not a little to composition, remains to be treated. For this, it is well to know what composition is in painting. I say composition is that rule in painting by which the parts fit together in the painted work. The greatest work of the painter is the Astoria.
Yeah, I think what's an Astoria?
Yeah, what's an Astoria?
It's a completed work.
A completed work?
Is that what it is? That's what I thought it was. Work, so.
Perhaps. What else?
I thought it was, I got the impression of the body.
Of the work?
Yeah.
What else?
Kind of theme.
A theme?
Yeah. Something that you
okay, theme that unites the work, okay. Well, let's see what he says about it. I mean, it's a word that's difficult to translate, so the fact that you don't know exactly what it is apt. The greatest work of the painter is the Astoria. Bodies are part of the Astoria. I'm reading right where I was on page 70. Members are part of the bodies, planes are part of the members. So there he's talking about Astoria in terms of composition. In terms of composition. Let's see what else he says about Astoria. Maybe it will elucidate for us what it means. Talks about it again on page 72. It would be well to repeat what composition is, and indeed he does. The greatest work of the painter is not a colossus, but an Astoria. Astoria gives greater renown to the intellect than any colossus. Bodies are part of the Astoria. He says that again.
If you knew what the colossus was, mm-hmm.
Colossus and colossal monumental work. Where else does he talk about it? What else does he say about the Astoria in this chapter? Yeah.
He talks about being the natural variety of the subject.
Yeah.
He talks about copiousness and then chaos. And how there's a fine line between putting enough in there to get you, keep you interested.
Yeah.
And then too much.
Right. So that's an important part of the Astoria, too. So you have to have proper variety, correct? But that does not mean, and you have to have proper a number of objects.
Yeah. It says with a dignity and truth, not chaos.
Yeah, so dignity and truth are an important part of the Astoria. Chaos is not. We talked about lack of chaos in this treatise. What did you say?
So harmony and size.
Exactly. Harmony and size are essential parts. But he doesn't want us to think that we need to fill up the canvas needlessly with disparate objects, right? Because there's also an economy that needs to be there. Good. What else is part of the Astoria? Are we getting it yet?
So is it kind of like the scope of the work, or is what it is that you're supposed to, including what you're not supposed to include?
Well, some of the harmony of realism.
Well, I mean, the Astoria is what is the word that he is using to describe the type of painting that he values. Astoria, you know, there's elements to the work that mean history, that mean narrative.
Yeah.
So he's talking about the subject matter, he's talking about the composition, he's talking about the style. Basically, it's the painting to which we all should aspire.
Okay.
And these are all the different components of it. Yeah, let's see what else he says about it in this chapter.
75.
Yeah, what's he say?
The story of which merits both praise and admiration is so agreeably and pleasantly attractive that it will capture the eye of whatever learned or unlearned person is looking at it and remove his soul. That which first gives pleasure in this story comes from copiousness and variety of things.
Right.
And it keeps going.
Right. And this is what you talked about over here. The story which merits both praise and admiration will be so agreeably and pleasantly attractive that it will capture the eye of whatever learned or unlearned person is looking at it and move the soul. So what is we've talked about this a little bit before. What is he saying there about the Astoria? What? Right. Good. What else?
He's showing his lack of prejudice that anyone, it would appeal not only to the learned, to the ones that can read the Latin, but it would appeal
he's
to
he's democratic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Appeal to all.
And what are the subjects, again, that he values?
Subjects.
Yeah.
The natural subjects.
Well, he says, the Astoria which merits both praise and admiration will be so agreeably and pleasantly attractive.
Beauty idealism.
Absolutely. Because it is beauty, it is the agreeable, the pleasantly attractive that will ultimately move the soul.
Because the
what were you gonna say?
No, I thought you went on to say something about like who you should, but it wasn't, it was like about the sheep, like everything should be kind of a proper mix of sheep, buildings, landscapes, everything
right.
Should just be, you know,
which is
places.
Which he feels is pleasant to the eye.
Yeah.
That,
he does
that
say
type of diversity.
He does say that those painters who feel they can leave nothing vacant are off base.
Exactly. Exactly. And he's referring to specific art historical styles there. On the next page he talks about the solitude in the Astoria. What does he think about solitude?
It's as bad as copiousness.
Right, it's bad. Just like you leave nothing vacant. What else? In the last couple pages, what else does he say about the Astoria?
Well, modesty and truth should be used in the Astoria.
Mm-hmm. Modesty and truth. And for this reason, be careful not to repeat the same gesture or pose.
Yeah, variety, he says, it's always pleasant in an Astoria.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The Astoria will move the soul of the beholder when each man painted there clearly shows the movement of his own soul. How is the soul moved? Alberti says specifically how the soul is moved. How does the painter move the soul? Now, he does so through creating pleasant appearances and that sort of thing. What?
Through the order.
Through the order, yes. He says specifically, though, what moves the soul in men.
The movement of his own soul, I guess the emotion that each character in the painting shows.
Yeah, and how did the emotions in the figures, how are they shown? How does the painter show them?
Through gestures and how they stand and how they...
Well, it says like herself, so like...
Right. Down further, actually, and I guess the next page, he says, in an Astoria, I like to see someone who admonishes and points out what is happening there or beckons with his hand to see or menaces with an angry face.
Right, exactly.
So he's saying specific emotions should be shown on different people and there should be a variety of emotion shown on each face.
Right. Yeah, he says on page 77... You read about modesty and truth should be used in every historia right below that, sort of in the middle of that paragraph. He says, it happens in nature that nothing more than herself is found capable of things like herself. We weep with the weeping, laugh with the laughing, and grieve with the grieving. These movements of the soul are made known by movements of the body. So when we see someone weeping in an artwork, we weep with them. When they are making a face that indicates sadness or grief, we weep with them. So it is through the actions of the human body that our soul is moved. And so that is why it is incredibly important that the painter pay close attention to the movements of the body. He says, go out and study humans, right? That's the subject matter of the painter. Go out and look at people. The visible realm is your subject matter. Go out and study the gesture of your subjects. How can you bring about emotion in the viewer?
I was going to say, especially how people display emotion with gestures, so you can then display it in your artwork.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear their...
Can't hear what they're saying?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just said that, especially like how humans display emotion, like through gestures and through facial expressions, so they can... Not just the emotion, but you know how
we express it,
how they can represent it in a painting.
Exactly. Okay, and finally, in this chapter, he talks about the reception of light, right?
Mm-hmm.
He talks about starting on 81. Oh, by the way, since he's talking about the motion, the movements of the body being capturing the movements of the body are responsible for moving the soul. He says that there are a certain number of movements of the body. How many movements can the body make?
Seven.
Yes. Relatedly, how many colors are there?
Four.
Yes. So the last part of the chapter is talking about color and light. And again, if the painter is there to represent things seen, then the reflection of light is how we actually see objects. It also helps us understand the vicissitudes of objects. Objects change depending on what type of light is reflecting upon them. And so the painter must study these vicissitudes in order to capture the visible world. Last chapter, book 3. I just want to sort of talk about one more thing, and then I want to show you a work by Masaccio that kind of represents some of these things that we've been talking about in Alberti, and then we can take a break. You guys take breaks, right?
Yeah.
The last chapter, what is the last chapter? What does it seem like to you? What is he saying in there? He's really already laid out his treatise here on painting. What is the last chapter dedicated to? Yeah, right. And what sort of man should a painter be? Yeah. Yes. And so with whom should a painter surround himself?
Good people, good art, and good citizens, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And he should try to surround himself with all those things that are worthy of being painted.
Sure. And what should he study besides everything he's told him to study so far? Exactly. Liberal arts. Mm-hmm. Liberal arts. He should surround himself with poets and orators. And it is through this milieu that he develops invention. Okay, so he surrounds himself with these literary minds, immerses himself in the liberal arts, and it is through those things that he can become truly inventive. He talks about invention on page 90. Anything else stand out to you in the last chapter?
Something I thought was worth quoting, where he said, nothing is ever so difficult that study and application cannot conquer. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty positive.
Yes, it is. And again, democratic. That this incredibly lofty discipline is ostensibly open to the masses, right? It can be, this great art can be achieved by many, perhaps. Okay. This is a painting by Masaccio. So again, painter was dead before Alberti ever wrote this treatise, but it is certainly the type of work that he is celebrating, especially in terms of the perspectival system. Can you see it? It's called the Holy Trinity. And it's in Santa Maria Novella. Should we turn on the light, you think?
Oh, I was just thinking. I think the walk that you're utterly in the dark.
Can you see it better?
Yes.
Okay. We're just going to spend a few minutes on these so you won't go to sleep. So this is a Masaccio work called Santa Maria called the Holy Trinity. It's in Santa Maria Novella, for which Alberti completed the facade. I showed you that. 1426 to 1427. It's a fresco.
What is the Holy Spirit?
Up above. Can you not see it? There's the dove up above the head of God the Father, which is above the head of the crucifixion of Jesus. What this is a tomb, essentially. It is paid for by these patrons, and they will be buried there. This is the patron of the fresco, and this is his wife. We have the Madonna, we have St. John. We have the crucified Christ, God the Father, and the dove represented all up above. Everything that you see here is painted, all in fresco. Mm-hmm. So although this looks sculptural, it's painted. What we have here represented is linear perspective, okay, sort of in its finest form. And indeed, Masaccio was probably following Brunelleschi's system, the architect who created the dome. He was probably following his system. And so, can anybody tell where the vanishing point might be?
God the Father, right above.
I would say the hips of Jesus.
Yeah, where he runs his stomach.
Right here?
Yeah.
Why? Where is the point from which everything else seems to...
I would say it was his arms.
Right here. It's actually right here. At the base of the cross. So all of the objects in the painting are geared towards that space. Okay, and that represents, of course, the height of the artist or of the ideal viewer. But you see how we have this Renaissance chapel being represented here, and this idealized perception in space. Okay, and within this niche, within this perfected graph of space, we have the Trinity being represented. Okay? And we have sort of two levels that are united by this vanishing point. Right? We have the Trinity up above with the figures, okay, with Madonna and St. John and the figures of the donors. And then down below we have this strange sort of fictive world that represents a tomb. It's not a tomb. As I said, it's painted. And we have the skeleton representing Adam's skeleton down there. And it says the inscription on the tomb is the perfect memento mori. It's the perfect memento of death. It says, I was once what you are, and what I am, you will become. I was once what you are, and what I am, you will become. So what does that mean?
Well,
you're going to die. Yes, exactly. Carpe diem. And so the system that Alberti is discussing, not exactly what Brunelleschi's system, is absolutely used in this work. And you see the representation of the figures in space, everything proportional to one another, everything geared towards the scale of the human body is signified here. So this is the type of painting that Alberti was absolutely inspired by. Now, what was inspired by Alberti? Well, lots. It was an incredibly widely read treatise. So translating it into the vernacular inspired this incredible reading of the work. I'm just showing you a work by an artist named Fra Angelico. And his annunciation in a monk's cell in the monastery of San Marco in Florence. So this is a painting that would be in one of the monk's cells. It would be a point of meditation for the monks when they retired. So we have the annunciation here. We have the Madonna and the angel. I show you this work. It's sort of complex how Fra Angelico was affected by Alberti, but he absolutely was. I show you this because it was certainly inspired by something that Alberti said. I think it's on page 77. Yes, page 77. Thank you. Oh, I'm on 76. No wonder I can't find it. Okay.